Hey, good morning. It's so good to be here with you. Can I come down a little closer? Is that okay? Is that all right? All right, cool. Oh, what? You can't see me now? Okay, now, come on. That's taking it too far on a Sunday. Closer? Well, it's good to see you all today, Doskask. Look, we've been in this really great series and looking over a collection of psalms, and we've titled the series as a soundtrack to a flourishing life. And a really big part of why this has been such a significant part of what we wanted to do this summer is that we just really believe that there are nuggets and pieces in the psalms that capture every human condition, every emotion that we will ever experience. And as if you have some time, maybe continuing through the summer into the fall, that you might actually stay in the Psalms yourself. Like that really is the hope here. And as we look through all of the kinds of emotions and conditions that we experience as individuals, but as a community, it's been such a breath of fresh air. And today, what I want to look at is specifically something that David pens in a really transparent, brutally honest way, which is this thing called fear, anxiety. And I think a lot of us, if not all of us, have experienced some form of that, some to higher degrees and others in other ways. But we've all felt that sense of anxiety, that pull, that rumbling inside the heart, and it's hard to get through. And so David kind of showcases his approach to anxiety, to fears. And I will say that a big part of this thing around fear is I hope we all hear that fear is just a natural part of a human's experience. And I am being told to go up because, Joel, you're right. No one can see me. Is that better? Okay. That there is this really belief that somehow fear is a bad thing, but it's not. It really is how God designed us. And in cases of imminent threat or harm, there is a natural response that we all feel, and that is to protect. In some cases, it will produce really good things like saving people's lives, your life. So fear is in itself not a bad thing. It's actually God's gift to us in great moments of crisis. And when you look at certain things in the world, sometimes anxiety pushes people to the next level. It can produce really great, beautiful, amazing results in a healthy way. And yet, when unchecked, sometimes fear does evolve into an anxiety that spins out of control, and can produce a hyper response, an over response, or sometimes an underwhelming response, like an underwhelming paralysis even. So if I fear, I don't know, being looked at as too short publicly, Joel, if I fear rejection, I might not ask for help. I might struggle with receiving help. I might never ask someone for help. And so I'm looked at as not collaborative or relational. If I fear kind of that, like, I've got to have it all put together, I might take longer to do something, or I might take an extraordinary amount of time to make a decision. And that might be seen as lazy or procrastination, but really that's just anxiety, because I'm just trying to make sure it's just right. And so it has nothing to do with my capacity. It has everything to do with my anxiety and fears. On the other side of that, you could be very, very hyper overreacting. With the same fear, you could lead into some kind of perfectionism, and now you're just overproducing, mastering and mastering something to the point of pure exhaustion, right? Because your fear of failure or needing to meet the mark because of your fear of failing pushes you to an nth degree. I grew up in a home where fear was really the middle name. I mean, I can tell you, culturally speaking, it was high performance. But that was because my dad was a high performer, and a lot of that was built on his fears. And he came to the States because he didn't want the violence that took his mom and dad and made him an orphan. And so he came over here believing that even though he was a poor kid, he could maybe make it here and have his family experience the wealth that he didn't have as a kid. And so coming here, he was like, there's no way I'm failing. That's not possible. It would be wrong. And so my dad worked 90-hour weeks every week. I remember growing up and thinking, dude, do I have a dad or not? Is this guy around? I mean, there are traces of him, usually his laundry and his balled up socks, always his balled up socks. oh, my mom would just, oh, what are these socks? Why are they here in the living room? But there would be traces of my dad. And I remember at the height of all of that, I was in, I think it's the 10th grade, he was working so many hours that he had worked himself to exhaustion that he fell down a flight of stairs fainting. And he came home early from work. I'm thinking, oh, my dad's home early from work. But no, he's got like bruised shoulders, a dislocated arm. His hip is like, he's limping. He's got some, you know, scar on his face. And I'm thinking, what happened to you? Did someone mug you? What's going on? And yet the next day at 6 a.m., he wakes up and he goes to work. Oh, immigrant, hardworking parents. I respect my dad. I miss him terribly. He passed a couple years ago, or over a year ago. There's not a single thing to my name. Any success I have is because of my parents. Every bit of it, all the sacrifice, all because of them. I can say that with absolute respect and love and affection. My dad missed a lot of my siblings' lives. I know I won't speak for them specifically on every area, but I think we needed a quarter of what my dad thought we needed to be happy. And I think, at least I would say, that I would have traded pretty much all of it to have more time with him. We had everything we needed to be educated and to experience the generational wealth I think deep down he wanted, and we all wanted for ourselves. And meanwhile, my mom was spiraling because she couldn't culturally assimilate here due to language barriers, and for a decade, she just felt really lonely. And she did it all by herself, really. And so you could be high performing in every area in terms of professionalism or the thing that you go after because of fears, but you could be dysfunctional in every other area of your life, emotionally, relationally, spiritually, physically. David says, there's neither this wrong or right with hyperactivity or underactivity with anxiety, but he shows a faith-centered way of approaching in all of that chaos and mess. And I want to look at it, Psalm 27, and if you want to know what my dad looked like when he was older, it's going to happen right now. Yes. Grandpa Chang. All right. Verse 1. Lord, the Lord is the light of my salvation. In chapter 27. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? So he opens the whole psalm with this fear. And as he opens this with this idea of fear, I want you to know we're going to go through all the next 13 verses and just read them and relate to him before we go back and study it, okay? Because I think sometimes when we look at fear, sometimes we look at these scriptures and we say, is it real? Can I even relate to it? So I just want you to feel what he's feeling. Let's not go to, is it rational? Is it irrational? Just, this is what he's feeling. And then we'll go back and look at all the great approaches that he has, okay? He says this. After he talks about fear, he says, when evildoers assail me in verse 2, and they eat up my flesh, my adversaries and foes, it is they who stumble and fall. Though any army encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war rise against me, yet I will be confident. In verse 2, it says, eat up my flesh. Now, all the commentaries say, like, it's probably hyperbole. And maybe there are some enemies that would eat him. I mean, there's probably some form of cannibalism. But I think we all agree that this is more than just hyperbole. This is how he feels. He is the height of his absolute anxiety to the point that he's saying all the pressures that he's experiencing, everything he's going through, feels like it's going to eat him alive. I think most of us would say that's anxiety, but I might say that feels like a panic attack. To me, it does anyway. And then he goes into this confidence thing. And I always struggle when the scriptures go, hey, anxiety and confidence, because I'm thinking to myself, like, is this genuine? Can you just have confidence even though you're going through all this turmoil? And I think it's more about what anxiety and working through that builds. It builds confidence. It's not like you just suddenly get confidence. If we ask God, hey, make me more loving, does he give us loving kindness or does he give us opportunities to be loving? If I pray for confidence, he's going to work through that anxiety so that I produce that confidence. It's sausage making. The other day, Miles says, Dad, you know how when you yum food, you know what I'm talking about? Like yum food, like, this is good. Like he's yumming this sausage breakfast thing I made for him. And he says, what is this round thing? I go, dude, that's a sausage. And then he asks me this impossible question. What's sausage. I'm like, I'm about 5 seconds into the answer, and I'm like, no. We're not going to talk about how sausage is made, and we're certainly not going to talk about what's inside sausage in this moment. Just enjoy it. Just eat it. All right. And so he's like, okay, whatever. Yeah, he goes back to his yum stuff. And this is what it is. It's so messy, anxiety. And I want you to feel the sausage making, because it does come out in confidence. We all like the confidence, but we have to go through what it takes to move through the anxiety. And so I just want to name that and just be honest about that. Verse 4 says, one thing have I asked of the Lord that will I seek after, that I might dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. And when it says inquire, there is no temple yet. So he's talking about finding the presence of God in what he envisions. There is a tent of meeting, but there is no full temple yet. So he's seeking his presence. And then he says, one thing have I asked of the Lord that will I seek after, that I'll dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, every day of my life, right? That I might dwell in the house of the Lord and gaze upon his beauty, right? For he will hide me in his shelter in the day of trouble. He will conceal me under the cover of his tent, and he will lift me high upon a rock. And here comes out the confidence, right? As he's found this safety, this shelter. And now my head shall be lifted up above my enemies all around me, and I will offer in his tent sacrifices with shouts of joy, and I will sing and make melody to the Lord. Right now, all those verbs are in the future tense. So it hasn't happened yet. And that is very important, because what he's saying is, this is how it's supposed to look. This is the picture. This is the vision. This is how it's supposed to feel. And then in verse 7 through 11 and 12, this is how it's really going, okay? Hear, O Lord, when I cry out loud. Be gracious to me and answer me. You've said time and time again, seek my face. My heart says to you, I'm trying. Your face, Lord, I will seek. Hide not your face from me. Turn not your servant away in anger. So he's struggling with this feeling like God is angry at him. Oh, you who have been my help, don't cast me off. Don't forsake me. Oh, God of my salvation, for my father and my mother have forsaken me. But the Lord, you'll take me in. And then he goes to like, okay, I need an answer. I need an answer, right? Teach me your way, O Lord, in verse 11. Lead me in the level path because of my enemies. And it's like table tennis. Then he goes back to his anxiety. But give me not up to the will of my adversaries, for false witnesses have risen against me and breathe out violence. So he's back and forth with what he's feeling. And then he has this faith statement. He says, but I believe that I'll look upon the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living, that he believes that at the end of all this, he will rise up and he will be okay. And all of this sausage making is all named under one thing, this response he calls waiting. Verse 14 says, so wait for the Lord. Be strong and let your heart take courage. Wait for the Lord. It's called waiting. In the midst of all of this reaction or underreaction, it's called waiting. It's called pausing. It's called sitting. It's taking 10 seconds before you say that next thing. Maybe 10 minutes, maybe 10 days, maybe 10 weeks, but whatever it is, take a beat. Pause. Process. But don't process and hope something good is going to happen as if you're inactive. It says, wait on the Lord. And I find it fascinating that he's penning and cognitively telling his own heart, as he pens this, hey, David, take courage. This is what we're going to do. We're going to wait on the Lord. He begins to process what he's starting to feel and go through. Wait on the Lord. Wait. Pause. Wait. And I know some of us are like, oh, well, then he's just taking over. No. He's not. That's not what it's about. Obviously, there are things that we all have to do. We have responsibilities. We're called to steward things in our lives and do that well. But what he's really saying is, hey, why don't you release yourself of having to be Lord? Or the burden of having to be omniscient and omnipotent in every situation before you can make a decision, before you can do something, before you can pick up the phone and call, before you can say yes to something, before you move into a connection point, whatever it is that creates anxiety. He's saying, why don't you release yourself of having to have it all perfect before you step into the next thing? Because that's a lot of burden. That's too much. So if I want someone to do something, I might use my omnipotence and my authority because I fear not getting something done. And so I might usurp them and might plow right over them, bully right over them and get something done. when it has absolutely nothing to do with the process, but because I am just so afraid of looking like I didn't meet the deadline that I'll go do that and hurt people. In my anxiety, in my fear, I might do that. Omniscience is funny because, you know, someone asked, some of you know I've been in this unique job transition scenario. Part of my program was defunded, and I won't get into all that political stuff. But then I was like, I'm in this contracting role, and I'm doing a lot of this fundraising, building fundraising platforms for nonprofits, and that's not why you came here to hear my story. But I've been interviewing for some roles, and this one question, just like, I must have woke up on the wrong side of the bed, yo. Question is, hey, fairly senior role, what's your 10-year vision for this thing? What's my 10-year vision? I got like a 10-day vision. Actually, I got a 10-hour vision, because I got to go pick up Miles after this interview. And then I said to CJ, I cook dinner. And then after that, I think I'm supposed to, you know, get swimming lessons because if we don't do that. Like, I got a 10-hour vision, and I think I said it out loud. I didn't get a call back. No one called me back. But you know what 10-year visions are? They're just places to say, hey, I fear who you are, so let me feel better about that situation by you being savvy and saying, here's my 10-year vision. As if I had a crystal ball and I could predict everything that happens in the next 10 years. Heck, I can't predict what happens tomorrow. That burden is too great. And trying to play that game of, I'm going to be in control of every situation, is what induces more anxiety. He says, hey, just take that burden off you. And that's when confidence begins to rise. And waiting on the Lord, there are really there are three things. And here's the approach. And I want you to know, it's a little bit linear, but I hope you know it's not prescriptive. There might be parts of this that you go, like, this really is helpful. And other parts of this that you go, oh, yeah, that would work. But ultimately, what I hope you see is this pattern that David uses. It's throughout all the Psalms, and it just seems to be the way he does it. But it's so illustrated here so well. So the three things about waiting on the Lord. It's gazing, it's naming, and it's listening. It's not name, it's naming. That's me, sorry. Just gazing. It's naming and listening, okay? Gazing, naming, and listening. That's so awesome. I want to keep that forever. Love it. Yeah, we love Jesus here too. Gazing. Verse 4 says this, one thing have I asked of the Lord that will I seek after, that I might dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. And then he says this, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. Oh, thank you for the name correction there, but it's naming. Don't know. Right? And that verse 4 says, to gaze. That word gaze is to say, hey, I'm going to focus. My intentionality is to focus deliberately on this thing, and that is God and his beauty. It's an intentionality. And the idea of beauty is not necessarily so much physical, though we've definitely seen in creation and all of that, but more about his character, right? It's all about his character. So if I'm struggling with forgiveness, I don't sit there and go inside and say, I'm just a horrible person at forgiving. I turn to God and his beauty. In his character, who is so perfect and loving. And there in that space, I understand what it looks like to be forgiven. And then I move to the things I am not. And so it's to gaze and have so much attention and focus on who he is in light of who he is, that we find this incredible moment of shelter and safety. And ultimately, our gratitude rises and we find perspective. We understand what suddenly really in the end matters. I asked CJ if I could have a little bit of a sabbatical, though I'm still working, but sort of, thank you. But I said, hey, I just need to get my head straight. I feel dizzy emotionally with all the transitions. And so I just asked, could I take some personal retreats through the summer? A very planned out one-day retreat. And so I've been going to this place on the coast, and I'll stick it on the screen for a second, but it's a picture of the coastline and it's off of the Oregon coast, northern Rockaway Beach, if you know where that's at. And there's this rock formation, and I'll spend hours sitting in one spot staring at this rock formation. And this big hole is always there, and then when the sun sets, it's filled with the sun. And it just reminds me, for me, this is just for me, how I feel like God fills certain voids in my life, right? And so I'll sit there and I'll read, I'll meditate, sometimes I'll listen to music. I'm there for a while, and I'll sit there, and it will sun, and it will set, and I will sense that this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. And I'm not trying to get something from it. I'm just appreciating it for what it is. And there's this gratitude that comes that I realize this is for me. I'm not trying to do more with it. I'm not trying to get something out of it. I'm not trying to get an answer out of it. I'm just saying, right now, in my head, I need to focus on this, and I'm growing in gratitude. And I've always got a cup of coffee in my hand. Well, actually, more than one cup, but I always have a cup of coffee in my hand, and it's always really warm, very hot, always black, never cream, because it doesn't stay warm with the cream in it. And I always feel the warmth on my fingertips. Because you know how it is on the Oregon coast. You know, winds on your face, sand blowing in your ear, right? Your hair, you look like a punk rocker by the end of it because your hair is all over the place. You feel it all. You get mad about the sand in your shoes. You feel your toes. You can sit and you suddenly realize you're alive. And you're grateful that you can breathe. And you've got some margin to do that. And now you have perspective. And that's what David has here. Listen to what he says here in verse 6. He says, or verse 5, he says, and now he will lift me high upon a rock. And then verse 6, he says, and now my head shall be lifted up above my enemies all around me. Right? What does he have? He has perspective. He can see now. He can see the forest from the trees. He knows what matters the most. And when he gets to that place, then he goes into what we call naming. Because verse 8 says, you have said, seek my face. My heart says to you, your face, Lord, I do seek. That's the gazing. That's the intent. And then he says, hide not your face from me. Listen to what he names. Turn not your servant away in anger. He's naming his biggest fears here. You've been my help, but don't cast me off. Don't forsake me. My mom and dad have forsaken me, but you don't forsake me. You know, what's his biggest fear in this moment? Is to be forsaken. Is to have had all this power in his life and to have been deemed an utter failure and to be left so far out that he looks like he can't do anything with his life. He's afraid of being alone. That's his greatest fear. And we can all relate to that. Forsaken by the job we thought we were going to get. Forsaken by the school we thought we were going to do. Forsaken by our dreams in athletics. I know some of us in this space dreamed about being the next XYZ player. Anybody over 6'3" has probably been told you could be the next, you know, whatever. And anybody my size was never told that. Right? But we have these things we build up and we think these are the things that we're going to pursue. These are the things that are going to be my dreams. And we're so worried. And then we get to these things and our jobs forsake us. The people that we think are going to love us back, they forsake us. We're constantly worried about being forsaken. We're constantly worried about being alone. Robin Williams, a great comedian, it's very cringy when you watch Mrs. Doubtfire. My kids can't watch 10 seconds of it without going, oh my gosh, Dad, turn that off. But in one of his movies, he says this, I used to think the worst thing in life was to end up all alone. It's not. The worst thing in life is to end up with people that make you feel all alone. You know, and while it might have been something from a movie, if you trace his life, most say this really was Robin Williams before he passed his whole life. He worried about being enough, being funny enough. He worried constantly about not remembering his lines. It was a deep performance culture. It was an individualism. It was a self-sufficiency that this message that our world tells us, you're only as valuable as what you can produce or what you can sustain or what you can accomplish yourself. And this is where imposter syndrome really comes from. David, in this moment, feels that if he doesn't accomplish what God has set out for him, he is this failure. But he can only be that honest with what my mentor says, honest with your soul, until he knows what really matters So he has the perspective, and now he's naming what really matters. And then when these two things come together, then he can listen. It says here in this verse, just in verse 11, it says, "Now teach me your way, O Lord, and lead me on a level path because of my enemies." Right? Because of my enemies. Teach me. That word there is instruct. It's not a big, deep Bible study. I know we love our Bible studies. It's not a theological lesson. We're not going into the Greek and the Hebrew. It's not dissecting and segmenting out the root verbs and all that. No, it's what is truth, meaning what's real, and how does that lead me in action, right? It's truth that leads to action. And what I love about this listening is he's really committing himself. He feels like he's in a place he can actually commit himself fully to whatever the will is, whatever instruction is. But here's what I love the most about this. He says, give me a level path. He doesn't want a downhill path. Some translations say straight path. But it's not like evaporate all the things in my life and let them all go away so it's easy now. Because David has responsibilities. It's not that those things go away. He can't suddenly say, like, I'm not a king. I can't say, no matter how stressful it is for me and me in my job transition, that I can suddenly say, I don't need to be a parent. It's not real. I can feel all the anxiety in the world, but if I don't love my kids, it doesn't matter. Right? There's just some things that God gives us that we have to do, even if there's anxiety. If I start struggle with anxiety at school, maybe test anxiety. That doesn't mean you're not going to take tests now. There's just some things in reality, like all these things that you have, all the pressures that we all feel. There's just a reality to everything that we go through. And he says, hey, I'm not looking for easy. I'm just looking for steady. And when you can find steady, the next thing, I'm not looking for grand slams. I'm not looking for home runs. I'm looking for a single. You know how sometimes we say, I just need a win? That's what he's saying. Just one step. You know, you can feel pretty confident with one step, can't you? And when you've been praying and listening, and maybe you've been getting counseling, or maybe there have been people in your life speaking truth, or maybe you've been praying, or maybe you've been reading things, and you're getting all of that information at the same time, and God is molding all of that and nudging you to this one thing. The one thing is a simple thing. The next thing to the thing that you need to do to overcome not just your anxiety, but the thing to do through your anxiety. Because ultimately, you can't just get rid of anxiety. So it's like the next thing, the steady thing. I think David's inviting us to truly wait on the Lord, to gaze on him, to focus on him, to find that perspective. And out of that place of like, oh my gosh, I'm alive. This is what really matters. I can then be really honest with myself and say, hey, this one thing has become the one thing, and it's creating all my insecurities, all my worries, all my angst all day long. But this is the thing that really matters. And so now I can just be truly brutally honest. Lord, don't let this thing in any way unhinge me and ruin this thing, right? And then in that space, you can just say, God, I'm desperate. It's okay. I do need answers, though. So what's my next thing? And walk me into the next. That's it. Just the next. That's called waiting on the Lord. In the hyper responses, in the underwhelming responses, that's waiting on the Lord. 4 months ago, I found myself staring at the mirror and saying, you are an effing loser. And I had no control over what I was leading. New mandates, new laws. I was completely powerless. I couldn't save jobs. I couldn't lead people. I couldn't guide vision. None of it was in my control anymore. And I felt like I was leading so poorly, and the anxiety was so high, I really did feel like I was failing all of those who were looking to me to give direction. And so almost for 3 or 4 months, I found myself saying this in front of the mirror in the morning. And it began to spiral into even darker places where I would say, I don't think your kids would ever want to be like you. And then it would go even further. I think about my dad and my parents, my mom, and they should have never had me. And in all of that space, in all of that negative thinking. I don't know how it came to be, but Tim's like, hey, we're doing a series in Psalms. What do you want to talk about? And I open up the scriptures and I say, we got to talk about this. And that began my 3 to 4 month journey of getting away and making the one thing, the most important thing, not the only thing, but the one thing I needed, which was to be with the Lord so I could find the perspective I needed so I could really be human again, is how I put it, and be myself. And the question after all of this, as I begin to listen and feel again and understand who I am in light of who he is, made me release the burden of having to be in control of everything, which was the source of all of my anxiety to begin with. And it's so much better now. But that took 4 months, just 4 long months of talking to people, getting friends, mentors, time alone. I think the question I have for us is, what are we listening to? And would there be a moment for you that you might stop and consider pausing and making God, who loves you so much, the one thing? And would you sit in that presence for as long as you need to, so that you could find perspective underneath his wings and in the shelter of his, that beautiful place we call the tent of meeting with him. And may you in that space just lay it all out, and may he answer you with, this is the next, this is the steady, or what Augustine said, this is the plain thing, not the fancy thing, the plain thing, the simple thing. And would you, out of just pure trust, because you've been that close to him, just do it. I pray that that is everyone's experience. And I'm going to invite the band to come forward, and we're going to take from the table. You know, in my kind of weird season, I will say I said to myself in somewhat of a skeptical, like God doesn't exist way, you know, why does this have to happen at all? I don't know if you've ever asked that of yourself when you go through difficulties or struggles, but why is this even happening to me at all? Did I do something wrong? I mean, David says it too here, like, why are you so angry with me? What did I do? Did I deserve this? Did I mess something up? Am I imperfect? Am I unholy? And what I can say is that if that's you, because I know it was me, I can say boldly, it's not because you're unholy and not imperfect, because I know for a fact that there is someone who is more perfect, and perfect actually, who also dealt with anxiety, and that is Jesus. And on his cross, in the Garden of Gethsemane, he is on the ground. If you read the stories, he is praying and asking God, would he take away this thing? And he's sweating out. Blood is coming out of his pores. The anxiety is so high. And he's listening, he's praying. And then he goes to the cross. And each step of the way, I think he's listening and he's listening. And there he confesses on a cross, oh God, why have you forsaken me, right? And even extends that great fear to, like, don't do anything dangerous to them. They don't know what they're doing. Don't forsake them either. And then he says on a cross, I commit myself to you. Because he believes, like David does in this psalm, that he will be standing in the goodness of God in the living. And he does, and he resurrects, and he's standing there. You know what the first thing he does? One of the first things he does is he goes fishing. I love that. That's my favorite part of the Gospels. The man goes fishing. He goes fishing. You know what? He catches fish. You know what he does? He makes breakfast. He makes a meal for his disciples who are full of anxiety because of one thing they need. The simple step, the next thing, the plain thing is a meal. He doesn't come with thunder. He doesn't come with chariots. He comes with breakfast. In a conversation, and the one question he has is this: do you love me? That's it. And everything is reset. Would you lay your burdens down here at a God who understands everything you're going through and then some? And would you do that knowing that you can name all of that, that what you are experiencing at his feet, and know you are never forsaken, for the cup that represents his blood and the bread that represents his body was shed for you, so that you would always know that you could come in the safety of his presence and name that thing. And then would you just say, teach me, show me the next, and give me the faith, the trust to just do the next. And believe me, he will.